Welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from The Margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. Phil, brother, comrade, fratello, paisan, how you doing, man?
All of those things and more. I'm in a good mood.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Super producer Matt Leck. And we have a...
Fresh off an away game.
Fresh off an away game. He's a little tired. He looks a little sluggish.
Been on the road.
Let me
take a day off with the back-to-backs.
Wait, hold on. I was over at my shorty's house.
Oh, man.
I'm going to make it up to you. I'm going to make it for real though. But all right, cool. Big Waz, Wazzy Lambre.
What's going
lazy
on,
lazy motherfucker?
After NBA a few true. Hiccups, you know what happens.
We had another hiccup the other day too, which we're gonna have to talk about off air. The logistics. Just messing with you.
Yeah, I was
you
like,
got
huh?
real serious.
No, I was like, wait, I'm trying to think. I'm like, wait, what was the other hiccup?
There's no other hiccup. But I do like that reaction. That's why we need Sean here to record.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of F-ups, Waz, let's get to the brand F-up of the week, the real brand F-up.
This lives in nerd world.
Yeah, so I don't even know what's happening here, so you definitely need to set this one up.
I can easily set it up. This is low-hanging fruit because it's just kind of funny. You know, for those who are not as...
It's culture jamming.
It is. Yeah. For those who are not as deeply ensconced in nerd world as I might be and others, Ghost in the Shell is a movie based off of a very, very popular manga, anime series, and movie.
Oh, like Make America Great Again?
Manga.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you said
manga. Manga, 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 manga. Manga with an N in there. That's very important. Making clear distinctions. But,
guys.
So this movie has had already its fair share of controversy because it's cast Scarlett Johansson in the principal role. So you have basically a whitewashing of the main character, who's obviously a Japanese woman that's now being played by Scarlett Johansson. Nonetheless, the movie will undoubtedly make huge amounts of money. That's not really the point here. But what they did do, Paramount, which is the film company, launched an online campaign to promote the film called IAmMajor.me, which allows anyone who goes to the website to upload photos of themselves. Then they can add different types of statements, not even necessarily about the movie, but just about anything else. So it's just a branding technique that they're using for Ghost in the Shell. And this went sideways, as many people who've been adamant about the fact that this is a whitewashing of a what can be a pretty significant movie, use this as an opportunity to, yes, upload pictures of themselves and some of the stars, but with catchphrases and slogans denouncing the whitewashing and white feminism in general. And then it went beyond Ghost in the Shell to include other more recent examples of whitewashing, like Avatar, The Last Airbender, the full-length movie, Iron Fist, the recent Netflix series that just came out, I think, this past weekend or maybe the weekend before that. So this
stuff on the Matt Damon movie.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, that Great Wall bullshit. Mm-hmm. So long story short, what was designed to be a promotional tool for the movie went completely sideways as people co-opted it to make it their own statements against Hollywood whitewashing.
Yeah, this falls in line. Well, this falls in line with two things. One, Hollywood, their basic business model of we got to get stars, and you know, conveniently, most of our stars are white, so it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, you can't look. I hate the player, hate the game. You know? Sorry.
You know, it falls
what
in line.
What can
with
we
that.
Do?
You know, right. And it doesn't interrogate the question of, well, why would that be? It's not because we promote them, no matter how many times they may fail or succeed. We'll still continue to put white people in our movies. It's not because of that. It's just that white
That's
people are inherently
more. That's
going to
be the name of my autobiography, by the way.
Of course. White
we
people
will
are just.
Still continue to put white people in our movies by Michael Brooks.
Yeah. It's just white people are just inherently more charismatic than everybody else. Clearly. That's why they make better movie stars, you know. But.
Yeah.
And it's also just a fundamental misunderstanding of how internet culture works.
Yeah, man.
You know, this idea that you're going to put this little site up and people aren't going to make a mockery of it. It's like that you couldn't prepare, that you couldn't foresee this coming. It reminds me of, like, you know, like, say, an NBA team will do, oh, we're doing a Q&A with Michael Jordan. Send your questions to this hashtag. And, of course, the people of NBA Twitter get to work with the most ridiculous and asinine questions possible.
Focus
right?
on the baseball career.
Yeah, this yeah. is just what yeah, we yeah. do on
That's
the internet.
That's what people do on the internet.
And, you yeah. know, you add to the fact that there's actually, you know, a social and moral imperative
right.
Around this movie and what Phil said with the Great Wall movie, where it's like, no, we can't just make a movie about the Great Wall of China without some white guy. It just wouldn't be possible.
Well, I mean, it was possible, but it wouldn't be as good.
Right.
But yeah, but no, I think that that's all true. And the most interesting thing to me is, like, when, you know, because Phil and I are always trying to talk about how to actually avoid these brand F-ups, even yeah. as we're castigating everybody, because in some ways, if you are avoiding brand F-ups, in some cases, it might mean that you're
not
avoiding
risks.
You know, deeper. Yeah, that could be on the positive side. On the flip side, like, sometimes brand F-ups just reflect the fact that you have really deeper problems. I think here, anybody with any social media awareness whatsoever, if anyone was in that room, just from a mercenary perspective, would have killed this idea. If you're in this room 6 months later and you're like, the casting of this film has caused a controversy, it generated a bunch of thought pieces, the shit is tailor-made for Twitter outrage, we're gonna do a generator website where people can come in and fuck with the ad campaign. I mean, it shows such an incredible lack of understanding that still exists of social media systems. And on the flip, I mean, you know, as much as, like, the kind of internet outrage culture gets exhausting and stupid, this is the good stuff because it's brilliant, yeah. it's funny,
right.
it's taking the mechanism and flipping it back in his face. And I like that. I like when the side of protest and what's right, I like when we're the funny ones. We're the ones, you know, disrupting things and kind of playing it in our court. So everybody who, you know, got to work on this site did a beautiful job. And
it's well deserved.
And it's very, very well deserved. But it's also shocking that nobody, just even from a cynical perspective involved in making this, didn't see this coming, like, 30 miles away with a clear view. With no fog, like, you know, this could have just been scripted.
Yeah, and so. And you know, to your point about how do you avoid these brand F-ups, it's like, yo, even before you make the marketing decision to do this and put, like, sort of the power and the buzz of your movie in the hands of fans that are clearly upset, is just make better fucking casting choices. Like, just make
well, that's what I mean about
better decisions from the beginning.
Well, that's
you know?
What I'm saying. When I said that sometimes dealing with brand F-ups mean that you've actually dealt with some serious problems and you've made better decisions. Now, I don't know what the bottom line is of a different casting call, but I know that if they cast a Japanese woman for this role, they would be getting love from us on this show. Oh. They'd have a completely different social media relationship. I don't know if it's at a point yet where they still could look at that and be like, yeah, but overseas, Scarlett Johansson's still going to make us better money. But in terms of the cultural dial and where they'd be going, if they made the right decision on this, they'd be acquiring a lot of capital for the long run.
It kind of sucks
cultural
because,
capital.
You know, I don't want to go too long on fucking this particular movie. The movie's going to be successful because people are going to see it sort of in spite of Scarlett Johansson.
Are you talking about yourself?
I'm actually not going to.
Not
like, even though
it,
I'm a huge fan of Ghost in a Shell.
Yeah.
And I it's one of the first, like, DVDs I got and all this kind of stuff, like, when that was a thing. I'm still not going to see the movie because I don't believe she was the right person to be cast in the movie.
Right.
You know? So I'm like, no, I'm not even going to fuck with it. It's kind of like with Iron Fist. Like, A, the shit sucks on Netflix and it's a big misstep for Marvel. But when I read today that they had a Asian actor, Louis Tan, who read for the lead and didn't get it.
Ooh.
And he got, like, they gave him the villain role.
Well, he's he's Asian.
Yeah, well, duh.
I don't know what part evil. This you guys. It was,
do you remember World War II?
Yeah,
I mean, seriously.
Internment camp.
You know, the thing is, the same reason that I won't watch Luke Cage. You know, they didn't cast a white guy.
Yeah,
it's just it yeah, made just, me more uneasy, you know? Like. Against watching Iron Fist, I'm like, yo, we in modern day times. Like, you could have given the dude the role. Like, these characters at this point, they transcend who's cast as the principal person.
Right.
You know, so that's my whole point on that.
That's the brand F up. We got to get to what's up.
Now we want to jump to what's up, and we will be dissecting, breaking down the latest album, playlist, mixtape, whatever opus. You want to call it. Opus. I hear it. The sides have been drawn in the room, and we're breaking down Drake's More Life. Which I'm co-signing with Big Waz. It is a masterpiece. Get ready to hear nothing but this album for the next
6 months at least.
I was gonna say a year to 18 months.
Seriously.
It's 22 tracks and there's not a weak track on it to me. You know, so I'm only speaking personally.
Right.
And you know, quick shots on why I think this shit is so important. Not just artistically, I think the music, this is the best thing Drake has done, I think. Even though his last few, he's always going to have hits, but there's sort of an uneven approach. I could listen to this all the way through and have several times since it came out. And I think that's a testament to where he stands in the culture right now, just not in hip hop culture, but really in pop culture. We're going to use pop culture as a barometer for who's most popular, who's most relevant. I think it's clearly Drake. Mm-hmm. And when he talked about not going to the Grammys and why he didn't go to the Grammys, and also he made a special notation about Hotline Bling and how it was nominated, for, I guess, for Best Rap Song of the Year. Yeah, Best Rap Song of the Year, which I think
it won. I don't remember because I don't pay attention to the bitch-ass Grammys.
Funny. Yeah, but that's a limited category.
And that's what he said.
Of course, and that was kind of his
point. He was like, this isn't a rap song. Not anywhere near on him like you two are, but that's objectively ridiculous.
Yeah,
that's
the idea that that
song.
Yeah.
That's a pop
song. It's just clearly pop. It's clearly one of the biggest songs.
Far beyond any genre.
You know, And again,
that's really ridiculous. I didn't even know that. That annoys me, actually. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
No, I mean, the last thing I'll say about Drake, and then obviously, well, we've already started opening it up because we're, like I said, kind of divided, is, you know, he's really stepping up, I think, as a curator. And that's what's really been interesting to me sonically. He's reaching out to artists. You know, many people have worked with Sampha, but Sampha's the truth. So anytime you can throw Sampha in the mix, I think is dope. But bringing more like grime artists to like mainstream, I think is huge. And he's got gigs on the record. He's got Skept on the record. They're making some of the more interesting music out right now. So those are some of the things that I really like gravitate to this record for. And then I'll kind of seed the mic on the Drake love.
Yeah, actually, I mean, before I get, I have one point of criticism, but let me actually get to that later. The thing that I did want to say, though, that I did kind of have in my notes that's interesting is, like, first of all, just the fact that this is a playlist, right, and using that sort of release approach where he's really explicitly kind of, I think, playing that role. You said that was a word for me, too. He's a curator. He's someone who really anticipates, understands, and has profited uniquely off of his ability to read and anticipate culture. He really is that kind of like trend analyst artist, which is interesting. And I think what I did appreciate about this while I was listening to this is, like, you know, there was the controversy with the other dude around Hotline Bling as an example. That's kind of like the extreme example. Yeah, like all that. So, you know, that in the past, is it that this guy is mimicking and exploiting, or simply, you know, just anticipating and carrying over? In this in this playlist, which is really what it is, he's using it to highlight all the other people that Phil's talking about. And one of the things that I did notice that's very interesting about this is he really, and I would say uniquely for what is like a hip hop album, I mean, he really is out of other people's way when he's highlighting them. Like, they're not, you know, like the Kanye song is a pretty Kanye song, you know, and so on. It's not like I'm jumping on a Drake track and trying to sound like Drake, if that makes sense. And I've noticed on other collaborations, you know, there's a little bit more of like, you can be on my shit, but you have to kind of conform to what I'm doing. He gives people a lot of space. So the way this is released, the success of it on Apple, how it was streamed on that Apple radio show that he has, like the role of curation, I mean, all of that is just objectively brilliant, and it's a pretty strong album. I am tired of his themes. Sure. Like, that is an artistic, you know, critique. And I joke about it, but I'm not categorically opposed to somebody rapping about love or frustration or anxiety. But I also do think at a certain point, it's like, it's an incredibly navel-grazing approach for non-navel-gazing times. And I think that, you know, in some ways, you know, he pushes back against, you know, the kind of like melt into the crowd, whatever kind of tracks, and he gives you something more visceral, and that's to be admired. And I'm not demanding that everybody be political or social or whatever. I don't agree with that. But I also just find like the whiny laments of a frustrated rapper in his dating life and needing to reassure me of how hard he worked, even though he was a child actor, to me, just thematically and artistically, is getting exhausting. And I actually would say it's a testament that I keep listening to the fact that he is just like objectively good at what he does. So my critique isn't even all that hard, but I wonder, like, when is the range going to happen, man? Or is this just it? Is this just the equivalent of, you know, the same loop that,
okay, like, for me, whenever Drake comes out, like, one, I'm a super fan, right? So I'm going to be excited for whatever this guy is putting out. And it's because, again, this is just my own opinion. You can share it, you cannot share it. I just happen to think he is one of the most talented artists that we've ever seen. And you can say, oh, he's not that good at rapping, or his flows are getting repetitive, or I'm tired of hearing about his bitches, or I'm tired of, you know, whatever. You can make whatever critiques you want. Just,
I'm tired of hearing about his feelings about his bitches. But at any rate,
I mean, but even that, I think, is kind of a narrow way to look at Drake's subject matter, because a lot of it is grounded in the fact that, you know, and no matter how you want to spin this, like, there's a certain universal acclaim that Drake will just never achieve in the way that, say, Kendrick Lamar does.
I agree.
And that's part of his griping, right? It's hard for him to say that I've done it all, that I've achieved it all, and, you know. And so for this project, what, you know, and I could just say what I personally found appealing about it is, one, it's the diversity of sound.
Yes.
As far as sonically. The people use the term genre bending, but Drake actually lives and breathes that idea and concept. You know, there's techno elements, there's Afrobeat, there's trap, there's reggae, there's R&B.
And that's part of that staying out of the way that I was saying.
Right.
In a weird, I mean, it's all him, but he's got a non-ego about that type of thing, which is distinct.
And for me, what I find most fascinating is, you know, we can all listen to say, you know, UK grime music, but I don't know that all of us, whoever you are, fan musician, can listen to UK grime, listen to Afrobeat, listen to old school house, and actually understand the essence of all of those different sounds and be able to execute it in such a way that it seems to come from a genuine place. Mm-hmm. The second part that I personally, and I've evolved in this in my fandom, is that I actually just enjoy the conversation about the Drake conversation, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, people hit my phone and because they know, like, I'm a Drizzy stan, like, it's going to be very hard for me to just straight up not enjoy some work that he puts out. But I'm interested in hearing the critique. You know, a buddy of mine, AJ, called me. He's like, you know, it's hard for me to not acknowledge that he's got three accents. You know, how genuine is that? You know, he's doing Jamaican patois. Like, is that authentic?
Right.
How are we supposed to feel about an artist doing that? Isn't art supposed to be about authenticity? I'm interested in all these questions. I talked to a homie of mine yesterday. He's like, you know what? Just as a straight up rap fanatic, I feel like Drake has been less inspired in his rapping. He doesn't, it seems like his flows are getting repetitive. He doesn't seem to be as inspired about making just purely dope ass raps.
Right.
But at the same token, he said, you know what? I'm interested in dancehall Drizzy. I'm interested in techno Drizzy. I'm interested in Afrobeat Drizzy. So, you know, I just love the conversation that Drake allows us to have about his music and the role of the biggest artists in rap. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about here, right? It's like, this is the guy who's basically carrying the flag for rap music to the world, and what's his responsibility to the form of rap? And I think that's what the biggest critique has kind of been. It's like, well, is he rapping as fast and as, you know, with the diverse flows of Kendrick and Cole?
No,
you know, where I'm just like, I just think Drake, and, you know, just through the conversation that I've had with people, they just feel like he looks at rap as a limit, it with limited returns, right? Like, I can only be so big as a rap star, but man, I can go far doing this Afro punk stuff. I can do Afrobeat stuff, or I can go far doing grime. Like, I can become an international beast. You never know. You might see Drake on a K-pop record.
Yeah,
you know, like,
oh, definitely.
You know, and this is the
I wouldn't be surprised.
And this is all new territory. If we're being completely honest with ourselves, to see somebody this ubiquitous in the culture of music, just literally doing everything that he can to become this international pop artist, is so nakedly and so, like, obviously, I mean, I think it's fascinating outside of the actual music, which of course we could talk about, you know.
I mean, Drake, I think, like, Drake is becoming like a stand-in almost for a long-running conversation around what is hip-hop.
Yes.
You know, what is authentic hip-hop? What does that mean? You know, there was a time when authentic hip-hop only meant, you know, what was happening in the five boroughs.
Right.
And maybe New Jersey.
Sure.
And, you know, with Redman or something like that. It didn't, like, we looked at, like, West Coast hip-hop until The Chronic as completely 100% unauthentic hip-hop.
Right.
And the artist that I look at, that I compare most, like Drake most to, in an odd way, is LL Cool J.
Yeah.
In the sense that LL came out with, like, My Radio and Rock the Bells. He was like that hyperactive, like,
he was an
straight ahead aggressive dude.
Yeah.
But then when he did I Need Love, that was like one of the first rap ballads, if you want to call it that, which became, it was popular, but it was a side eye look at LL for a lot of dudes who felt like, yo, that's not what rappers
do
talk about. That's not what we do,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, and when he came out with that Walk Like a Panther album, where he had like that, I'm that type of guy. Like, I'm deep in the LL discography now.
Right.
That was like, that almost killed his career.
Sure.
So, like, all his other records after that were kind of rebuilding himself as like a tough guy, more traditional rapper. And then hip hop and R&B kind of melded in a way where it was okay for him to do songs with like Boyz II Men and more of his ballady type stuff. But Drake is having that same moment in a modern day setting,
right,
where we're talking about his themes and like, yo, he's bitch because he's talking about this or that.
Yeah,
or
I'm not saying,
not
I'll
in this
room, but
I'm saying generally.
Yeah,
these are serious
I
reasons
understand.
Why people
I get
like,
that but
Ghost,
I think
like Ghostface, for a quick example, like, he, when he wrote like this, he has this funny ass critique of rappers. Like, it wasn't this album, but it's like maybe two Drake albums where they took like Drake's face and put it in like the biological picture of like a pussy. You know, like that was like the picture. Like right. It was like the Drake record.
Yeah, where he nothing has,
like,
was the same. Yeah.
Yeah, and his like face is.
I like
profile.
That Waz is like, I'm still hurt.
But have you seen? Nah. You've seen that, right?
No, I haven't.
Yeah,
seen
it's
that.
Funny as hell. But it's like literally like the biological pussy with like Drake's face like floating there.
Wait, hold up. It's the biological pussy?
Because you know,
no,
like,
I'm just messing with you. I got it.
The X, like,
no, I'm just playing.
You know,
I understand.
X-ray that joint, not the beautiful version.
I understand, but I think, you know, I guess my thing is like, I don't, whatever, rap about whatever you want to rap about. I think what it is in the context of this conversation, I just think for me, and obviously there's a lot of interest around the dude because he is a talented person and he is interesting and he generates conversation. But at today's specific moment with all of the shit happening, and I'm not just I'm talking about the politics, but I'm talking about everything. It's a very fucking complicated time. To me, like, one man's quest to be a certain kind of pop icon, along with like constant personal gripes, is on some level like it starts becoming and it's very, very different, but almost like a dude like Martin Amis as a writer. You know, he's a great stylist, very entertaining novels, very cynical, like caught a certain part of like a London scene and a literary scene. But at a certain point, it's like, why do I care about Martin Amis's like writer friend, tennis partner that he hates,
right,
and how his marriage is falling apart? Like it isn't, it's the different, it's one thing to say you shouldn't talk about those things because that's not what a real man talks about or some bullshit like that. That's nonsense. Okay, I'm certainly not gonna make that argument, but it does get to a certain point where it's like, if all, just on the flip side, by the way, if somebody only comes out with like hyper-conscious, political, like, and everything has to have a point, everything, like, maybe Kendrick actually tiptoes to that other extreme. Like, right. That might be a valid critique of him. But at this moment, specifically and in general artistically, to me, it really does start to become the thematics and then also just that, like, one person's quest to achieve some shit is of limited interest to me unless that has like a really big ramification that affects me, frankly. Maybe that's where I'm like Drake. I'm selfish too. I'm like, well, I'm trying to do my own shit. Good luck to you. Yeah. I don't care about your process. You know what I mean?
Yeah, what I would say to that, and you know, and that's something that somebody like me who doesn't come from the school of backpackers and underground, and frankly, you know, guys like Nas or even you could say like a Tribe Called Quest. Like
definitely Tribe Called Quest. I'm not get into the Nas thing. I can't call Nas a backpack rapper, but whatever.
Well, no, I wouldn't see Nas is like
not a backpack rapper.
He's not a backpack rapper, but he's who every backpacker fancies themselves as.
That could
so that's like if
minus
a backpacker
a lot of
could
tracks.
Wake up one day and be his most ideal self, he would actually be Nas. That's why I always he's the Jesus of backpackers.
But really, he's Jurassic 5, and no one's talking about that.
Sure, I mean, you know, I think the that's a fair critique, you know, this idea that Drake is not a social commentary. Like, there's no social commentary coming from him. I would say, like, you know, if the guy doesn't have something really good to say that isn't as, you know, pointed and, you know, and I think part of what makes Drake a great writer, I think he says a lot with a little bit. Mm-hmm. He doesn't he's very minimalist in his writing approach, and he's able to say, like, some pretty, like, just detailed shit. You know, if he's not going to be able to apply that level of writing to it, I don't know that it's a worthwhile endeavor for him.
Yeah.
Idea that he shouldn't try to pursue it, that's neither here nor there for me. I think part of, again, the thing about Drake's music to me is that it actually literally lives out in the world. Meaning, like, I'm going to go on my Instagram. The next 70 girls that I see is going to be a freaking Drake quote that they've now applied to their life.
That is the
I'm going to go out in the summertime to a rooftop, a backyard party, and people are going to be dancing and having fun to this guy's specific music. And you know, one last thing I want to say about just Drake's choices as an artist. You know, I was talking to somebody, you know, and he was like, you know, Drake is actually a culture vulture, which you spoke to, but in the most like best way that you could describe somebody that way, right?
Right.
And I want to just say, like, these artists, they live in mortal fear of ever losing their audience.
Yeah.
And so for Drake to go out time after time again and go find the weirdest shit to put on his songs, and people might say he's wave jumping. Your favorite artist wouldn't even bother.
No, they wouldn't.
This is like, and I'm not going to go put no UK cat on my joint.
And ironically, I'm contradicting myself, but part of the reason he maintains that connection is because of the emotional shit.
Yeah.
He established that emotional bond that and openness, man, and that allowed him to fuck
around. That every man facade is definitely a big part of Drake's opinion. Is this idea that he's just like you. People shit on him. People, you know, slight him. He doesn't get all the accolades at his job. He tries very consciously to, you know, stay on that every man track, as genuine as it may be for a guy that fucking rich, successful, and, you know, big in what he does. So yeah, that's what I would want to say. Like, the amount of bravery that it takes, just artistically, not like jumping into a burning building, but to achieve the level of success that this guy has, and to go out and try to constantly evolve sonically, you know. Not necessarily thematically, although again, like, I'm not gonna get tired of people crying about the chicks that dumped them and or getting new chicks and making chicks jealous or look at what you're missing out. Like, I mean, it's petty, but that's life. You know,
that's life. Yo, I mean, I think it's a diaspora record. Like, to a certain extent, like the culture vulture parts of it. I know people have that critique. But I'm like, yo, if the dude grew up like, you know, we both West Indian, you know, and
that's right.
You have a certain thing, I think, when you come from these cultures where I'm like, he's not. I mean, but he grew up in Toronto. That's a heavy West Indian community. Like, West Indian people go three places: New York, Miami, Toronto, and London.
And London.
So it's not weird to me that he would gravitate toward certain sounds. So when people say like, oh, he's culture vulture, and that's a act that, and they want to make that assessment, I'm like, well, that's not really assessing like where this person is from, like where they grew up. Like, when I listen to the record, I understand it, because I'm like, yo, I could be at Austin's and I'm gonna hear Drake. Like, he's one of the few rappers. Like, when I was home in June, is almost a year, unfortunately, you don't really hear that much hip hop in the West Indies, you know, at least in Barbados.
Right.
And when I was there, like, and maybe it's because of him and Rihanna and their relationship. Rihanna is worshipped.
Yeah, I mean, at home. Rightfully so.
Yeah, worshipped at home. So
worshipped at my home as well.
So you hear his music. He's one of the few rappers that you hear. So when he's embracing all these different groups like grime music and stuff, like, I can relate to that.
No,
maybe that's what
I think it's
hearing,
it's
and
capturing.
Feeling is like that diaspora music, like reaching out to like Black Coffee. Like, that's a track, like, when I play house music, I play some of his music because it's, people don't know it, so it's kind of like I look original, but it's like but it has like a different cadence and beat to like traditional house, but it's steeped in that tradition. And I respect that, like, you drawing from all these different places where we are and have been, and pulling all that music together to make it universal.
Well, we got to get to what's next. I just got to say real quick, Rihanna, super producer Matt Luck told me once that because of Rihanna is what flipped his position on integration. So she's a major figure. We got to get to what's next. All right, so now we got to get to what's next. And we've talked a lot on this show about social media harassment, not just what Big Waz gets up to when he's out on the prowl for his shorties, but also the really, or me for that matter at certain times. And obviously, first and foremost, super producer Matt. But also the sort of dark side of internet harassment culture. We've talked about how misogyny, harassment of women on Twitter, is not only obviously an ethical problem, but it's even something that has potentially inhibited Twitter's business growth, made it a less desirable company to be acquired. Obviously, we're in the kind of alt-right age, so a lot of things that maybe if you were like me, you might have even dismissed as just the sort of internet ravings of resentful virgins. All of a sudden, some of those people are setting policy in the White House. So it takes on a kind of different level of import. And this story from Wired magazine deals with a new proposal that is coming from Germany by Germany's Minister of Justice and Consumer Protections. And he's basically, his name is Heiko Maas. And he's proposing a law that would fine social media companies up to 50 million euros, that's 53 million bucks, for not responding quickly enough to reports of illegal content or hate speech. This would apply to all platforms, Google, Twitter, YouTube, all of that. You know, one distinction that should be, you know, set on the table for this is that Germany already does have, you know, restrictions on speech.
Which is interesting.
You can't. You know, there's definitely speech related to hate speech, specifically, arising out of the Nazi era, but it's been, you know, broadened to some extent to affect other groups as well. Obviously, in the United States, we don't,
United States, we haven't had anything similar to the Holocaust.
Yeah, we don't do shit like that. Yeah, we have a really clean record.
So. We haven't,
disagree with that.
Yeah, no. You know, like,
some people had some, rough immigration experiences.
That wasn't really that bad. Or anything.
The Native Americans were happy to have an opportunity to be in a powerful country.
Of course.
So that is an important distinction. But I think this Wired article critiques the proposal somewhat on kind of free speech grounds as well. But it's interesting to me that the fine is not about restricting speech. The fine is about not responding to reports quickly enough. Those are very different things.
Sure.
Speech is one thing. The response to speech is also free speech, incidentally. And it just strikes me, I don't know whether or not this proposal is right. That's my honest kind of feel. I would need to assess it more and learn more about it. But we're definitely heading into a time when across a whole range of things, from consumer protections to privacy and to hate speech and online harassment, we're going to need to start thinking of what is the kind of 21st century Bill of Rights for the digital age. And these conversations are going to come at us more and more. So I wanted to open it up and see what you gentlemen think about this specifically and more broadly.
Yeah, this speaks to a broader conversation about the role, I'm tired of talking about our new regime. But, you know, they've brought in this, we've got this new regime, and it's a very anti-regulation regime, right? If you're a Republican, it's free trade, free market, free this, free that.
Well, it's anti-regulation to protect people in the environment. It's pro-regulation in terms of rewriting legislation to help businesses and special interests.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's an important distinction, because some people say no regulation. That's not what they're talking about.
No, of course not.
Talking about writing it to benefit certain people and industries.
The idea of any regulation to me, right, is that if you don't put in place certain restrictions or punishments or recriminations in the way of a big-ass company whose incentives are just making money.
Right.
They're not going to do it themselves.
Never.
It's been proven. It's been borne out over and over again. It's not that Twitter wouldn't want to not have people get, you know, hurt and abused and harassed online. It's we have no financial incentive to stop this.
Well, in fact, it's only time they've started kicking people off and shit is because of the financial hits.
So there you go. Yeah. So if there is no, financial incentive attached to to policing this stuff, it is the role of a government to be like, look, man, you gotta shapen up. Because again, it doesn't matter whether it be labor laws, environmental laws, it doesn't matter. Companies don't do this on their own.
That's right.
They need to be nudged in that direction. So it
needs to be regulated in that direction.
Yes, yeah. Well,
not just
I say
nudged. Yeah.
But yeah, you know me, I take a goddamn sledgehammer to those motherfuckers.
Yeah, that's right.
But right. And you know,
we're like the only business podcast that is like, why has Google already been nationalized.
Exactly.
Yeah, innovate your way out of your earnings getting reappropriated, yeah. Uber. How about that? I know about innovators. I know about being in the hills in Cuba, motherfucker.
Yeah, and that's the sort of leftist and what we call lefties here, which are liberals. That's that sort of conversation. But, you know, that's what I'm more interested in. It's this idea that a government is going to step in and be like, look, and particularly Facebook and Twitter, where you can be targeted, right?
Right.
And Google, you have to kind of go out and find Stormfront, right? Whereas
that's a really important distinction.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. On Twitter, right. Stormfront can come to your front door.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, and the we use Twitter, especially if you're somebody like us, where it's like, this is where I get my
work.
Yes.
And we have a public profile.
I have to be on here.
That's right.
It's important that you protect your users in that way. So, you know, I obviously I'm a commie, so I'm all for it.
Yeah. They have to find a way to get this right. And you know, maybe, you know, the article kind of leads you down a particular way because they say like flawed plan and,
right,
you know, but we have to have the conversation, like,
absolutely,
what is often missing when people have these sort of broad-based critiques of some sort of plan around retribution or making some sort of financial allowances is just the size and scope and intensity to which these companies inhabit your life.
That's right.
You know, they have an outsized way of impacting everything that we do, where there are no models that exist from sort of a industrial age type of economy.
Yeah.
These companies have transcended that. They are literally, like, we're not talking about Model T Ford cars or other sort of things like that. They're the road. They're the literal road to which we find information, we communicate, and policing that is the responsibility of the government in ways that the private industry won't police itself.
That's
and that distinction that you guys have made around a regulatory environment, and you're spot on, the branding that conservatives will use is that we want to get rid of regulations. And I think, you know, Waj, you hit on the branding, and then Michael, you came back with the reality that it's not about not having regulations. It's about who's being regulated,
right,
and to what
to
end.
What end?
You right. know,
there's always regulation,
and that's what's critical. There's always regulation.
There's always regulation. It's the question of who it benefits, and that whole thing is one of the greatest. And especially also, I would say from an actual business perspective too, because if you're a non-incumbent and you want to get into a crowded space, you better be thinking seriously. You don't. If you were just thinking, "Oh yeah, I want no regulation. I'm a business person," then you're an idiot. Because you want something that's going to help open up the space for you. But I think the thing that you guys are both hitting on that's really important is that these companies are now utilities for the world we're in. And that's the other kind of contradictory thing about Silicon Valley. It's like, on one hand, we can all kind of agree in some ways that, like, it's goofy on some level, maybe with the exception of Google, because these companies aren't making cars. They aren't, and they aren't even in the business of, like, you know, oil or something, which are like evil businesses, but it's kind of important.
Right.
It's kind of a big deal. It's kind of
to
like
heat your home.
Yeah, we heat our homes, we drive, the whole global system operates on all of them. And all of this money and all of this capital is being made to, like, order a sandwich more efficiently and watch porn. On some level, that's goofy. But then on the other hand, these companies define our modern work lives. Many aspects of our social lives, our relationship lives, they're only getting more and more sophisticated and ruthless. And then at the same time that they're going to talk about how revolutionary and indispensable they are, then they also still want to kind of jump back into, like, the, you know, we're just neutral platforms and we're just these friendly people, you know, tinkering new solutions. They have, to their credit, with government help, because government allowed the internet to be and helped and created the internet. So we also can't forget that story. They've turned themselves into utilities of the modern age. And as soon as you're a utility, you need to be regulated in a radically different way. And so the important part about this proposal from Germany to me, to loop it back, is that it's not a free speech question. It is a harassment question. A harassment question is a consumer protection question. And that all of a sudden gets us into a very different conversation than, again, I'll use the favorite phrase of the show, navel gazing, about who should and shouldn't have free speech on these platforms. Because I agree with you, Wes. Like, yeah, look, I don't think anybody should be excluded from Google unless they're, you know, representing a crime.
Yeah,
right?
Like child pornography.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's like the classic example that you can't have anywhere, of course. But you can write and promote any sick, disgusting shit you want. But when you're on Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook, then you're in the realm of interactivity. That makes how you're putting that speech out and who you're targeting at a completely different proposition. That's a good distinction.
And one quick thing I'll add, like the short-term way that these companies view the way they run their business actually hurts them.
Right.
Because there was a story recently around how Twitter, which has had its issues and was trying to, it was up for sale.
Yeah, yeah, I mentioned that before. Yeah, yeah.
And Disney basically said they weren't going to do
it.
That
was the company, right?
Yeah. So that affected their long-term strategy,
right,
in a way, because they've been refused to take on sort of the darker, seedier elements of what the service has to offer. And that's problematic. I think if these companies really bought into their marketing about serving greater goods, they would figure out a way to get this right. I know they won't, because they don't give a shit, but I'm just saying, if, like, in the imaginary world of if.
The reason why you said that's short-sighted as well, I think the harassment thing, it discourages user engagement, right? Mm-hmm. Like this idea that you wouldn't want people to stay on Twitter 24 hours a fucking day.
Right.
Like that's what you want. If you have, say, 10 people doing that rather than 100 people passively, right, those 10 people are more valuable.
Dude, I've taken breaks because I'm like, all right, now I've got to get like fucking, you know, 300 teenagers who think they understand Islam are going to harass me about some nonsense that I'm not going to read.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to turn that off.
Yeah. So, you know, this idea that you would discourage engagement by not policing this abusive behavior, I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of your own product, quite frankly. Like, if you want to sell people stuff, it's a lot easier to do so if you can just have them there all the freaking time. And if you're discouraging, especially, you know, and again, this gets to the kinds of people that most companies just don't give a fuck about, minorities and women.
Right.
Like, you're discouraging those types
even
of
though
users.
Even though they're the prime users. I was just thinking, though, they could start designing the algorithms. Like, oh, it's like, oh, she getting harassed. You can go pop a Mace ad up in her feed.
Hey, there you go.
Solutions. I can do free markets. I can do free market solutions, too. But it sounds like maybe social media needs a little bit of German efficiency. And that's what's next. We got to get to the crates. All right, so now we got to get to the crates. These are your picks from culture, make your life better, stronger, faster, more nimble, all of that. Phil, let me start with you.
All right. I'm picking an artist. I'm not going to single out one particular album. He's a UK soul singer. His name is Omar. Sometimes he's tough to find because there's like other Omars that start to pop up when you do Google searches. But to me, he's like he would just say soul. But if you listen to a lot of his stuff from like the mid-2000s, for example, he has a sound that's very reminiscent of what was going on here from a neo soul perspective, but also going back to like bands like Soul to Soul and Loose Ends, like very obviously identifiable UK R&B artist. So he kind of, to me, melded those two together. And I think he's an amazing artist. I was lucky to see him years ago on one of his rare appearances in New York. He played at Joe's Pub, and it was an amazing show. I haven't seen him since because he doesn't come to the U.S. very often, but I would definitely recommend just the assorted discography of U.K. soul singer Omar.
Cool. Big Wise.
So I have two recommendations. the first, obviously, you know, I sat here and basically sang the praises of Drake's new album or playlist, which as a quick addendum, like,
stop it.
It seemed like you know, like that the concept of like, this is a curated playlist of all songs that
but
I want.
But it was, though.
I get it, but I don't know. That gimmick didn't really grab me, you know. But whatever. I enjoyed the album regardless of my buying into or not of the gimmick of it being a playlist concept. But, yeah, I want to recommend one particular song on there, and it's a song called Passion Fruit. It's track number 3 on the album. It's... and I'm drawing a blank. It's got a sample from this this famous Detroit house DJ's, one of his old sets. Like he kind of sampled like a little drop from the dude. And what I enjoyed about this particular record is, one, it's this idea that, and it's not the first time Drake has dabbled in house music, particularly, or what they call deep house, but it's his ability to tap into the essence of what a house song is, does, how it's supposed to feel. Like, if you've ever been to, like, house music isn't the type of thing that you kind of listen to by yourself in your room with the lights closed, right? This is something you go out and listen to with people, you know.
Yeah.
And Drake's ability to sort of pretty much nail the vibe of what a great house track sounds like, I think was pretty impressive. So I would encourage people to write that. I mean, to listen to that. And something slightly related is this Beatles doc that Ron Howard did. It's on Hulu right now. I watched it like a week and a half ago. I've never been a huge Ron Howard fan as a director, but, you know, he's a talented dude. I thought this doc was interesting in that, you know, Drake is basically a pop icon now, but the Beatles basically, they invented...
the original pop icon.
Yes, they invented the idea of a pop icon. They invented the idea of what we now call a modern pop song.
Yeah.
You know, and this documentary kind of documented their splash into... American culture and world culture, period, as not just in, they weren't just music, they were symbols, you know, a phenomenon unlike, quite frankly, we've ever seen since, except for maybe you could probably compare Michael in his prime.
Yeah, Michael, right?
You know, or even Elvis to a certain extent. But the Beatles were basically the first of their kind. There's never been anything like this, the kind of crowds, the kind of hysteria that they... that they inspired. And I think the doc did a good job of documenting that, the type of emotional, personal toll that takes on these artists. Because I feel like a lot of times, you know, we lose sight of the fact that these are just dudes.
Yeah.
You know, these are just human beings. I think the doc did a really cool job of that. And they didn't really delve into the actual musical genius of these brothers, but a little bit they did. They kind of got to show you not only were they popular because girls like what they look like, but their actual music was very creative, very avant-garde even.
Mm-hmm.
In their approach, so you should check that out.
Definitely. So I want to recommend a book called An End to Suffering, The Buddha in the World by a guy named Pankaj Mishra, who has a new book out called Age of Anger, which I recommend everybody check out too, which I just started. But Pankaj Mishra is an Indian writer who really does a lot of interesting work kind of like disrupting the ideas of what is East and what is West, and showing us that even in a lot of things that are sort of quote-unquote Oriental nightmares, whether it's like the Iranian Revolution or Mao or Stalin, are actually in many ways Western projects, or what we would call quote-unquote Western projects, and kind of disrupting those categories. And this book, An End to Suffering, The Buddha in the World, is partially like a memoir, and he's an interesting dude. He grew up in a poor but Brahmin family in India, went to college in India, and then kind of went off on his own and both started kind of building the blocks of what would take him to sort of like international literary fame, but also like being in his 20s living in like remote Indian outposts on his own and trying to figure out the Buddha. And the parallels he draws with Buddhism are really interesting because in some ways the period of time that the Buddha lived in actually could in some ways resemble our own. Within his historic zone, it was a merchant and trade culture. There was a lot of political disruption. There was new classes and forms of trade arising. And this sort of strategy that this dude came up with in, you know, very ancient times for sort of like dealing with suffering and being human are definitely pretty distinct, particularly from the perspective of religious teaching, because they're definitely not, they're not reliant on a supernatural account of anything. But he also notes that at that time there were other people, you know, competing philosophers who had even more kind of nihilistic worldviews. So it's interesting to get into that time and realize that in every environment there's always argument going on and how that strategy developed. So An End to Suffering, The Buddha in the World by Pankaj Mishra, who's a good writer in general, very interesting dude. Waz, you came through.
Yo.
Crew.
This was great, as big, usual.
As gosh. Usual. Well, we know Big Waz is the That's comrade. What we do. He's the man. He's the friend. He's the comrade. He's the fratello. He's all that shit, too. Phil, another journey, brother. Thank all you. Good. Super producer Matt Leck.
Trap.
Shauna Wan, creative director. You know all the places you can follow us. Come on, you know what it is. Email us something clever. Shoot it something. We might read it on air. See you on Thursday for On Point.